The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening, and welcome to a brand new series of The History Show. On this week's programme, when Laurel and Hardy came to Ireland.
They could hear screaming and shouting, and they're going, this is crazy, there must be someone on the boat really famous. Because as they neared the quayside, they could hear the children and the adults shouting, Laurel and Hardy.
The story of the famous comedy team's visit in 1953 and the rapturous reception they received in Cove. Also, the history of the All-Ireland rugby team.
The rugby authorities decided that they would just simply ignore the border. They pretended as if it didn't exist because they really wanted to maintain the unity of the game as far as was possible.
I'll be joined by Liam O'Callaghan, author of the new book Blood and Thunder. Plus, the life and afterlife of St. Bridget. And that's where we begin this evening. St. Bridget of Kildare is someone who means a lot of different things to different people. She's a patron saint of Ireland, a figure of devotion for many. To others, she's the Celtic goddess of pre-Christian Ireland. She's also a symbol of female empowerment and a feminist icon. It's purportedly been about 1,500 years since Bridget of Kildare died. And as part of the ongoing Bridget 1500 programme of events from Kildare County Council, the Bridget's Worlds Conference is taking place at Maynooth University this coming Friday and Saturday, the 13th and 14th of September. I'm joined by Maynooth University's Dr. Niamh Witcherly, a medieval historian in the Department of Early Irish, specialising in the Early Irish Church. You're very welcome indeed, Niamh, to the History Show.
Thanks a million for having me.
Now, Bridget is someone who's been enjoying a huge resurgence of popularity recently. We're all very grateful to her for the public holiday in her name. In recent years, though, you've been on a mission to show that we should really be celebrating not the goddess, not the miracle-working saint, but the flesh and blood woman.
Yeah, in actual fact, I'd say celebrating the goddess is fantastic. Celebrating the saint is equally fantastic. It's actually that kind of third element, the real woman, that flesh and blood human being. That's, you know, the Bridget that I feel has been slightly kind of forgotten about in all of the devotions and commemorations and everything around Bridget over the last couple of years. So this conference that we have coming up in Maynooth on Friday and Saturday, we're really getting back to that earliest history of when Bridget lived, when she was first remembered, and her early Church of Kildare, that early foundation, which went on to become one of the biggest and most influential institutions in the country. This was, you know, a kind of a pre-Dublin time where, you know, Dublin didn't really exist per se. You know, I mean, it did, but all roads lead to Dublin, kind of in Ireland now a little bit. And this is a time when, you know, more of the roads were leading towards Kildare. The Kildare was a big deal. And we don't explore that enough in many ways in Irish history.
Now, I think her Dictionary of Irish Biography entry more or less suggests that she is a myth. As a person, she is a myth. And, you know, I mean, you were a sceptic at one stage yourself, weren't you?
I was because, you know, I think it's important for people to understand that history is a science. You know, it's an iterative process. We build on the work of people that went before us, you know, and we're all also influenced by it. When you start out and you're a student and you follow the people that came before you, and then as you kind of grow in, you know, confidence yourself, you are able to maybe challenge, you know, earlier ideas and notions. And the more I got into, just really, to be honest, Miles, over the last few years, when I've been asked to kind of talk about Bridget in so many different forums, you know, so many different fora, you know, to community engagement and also academic events and to the media, I really had to reflect on what I really thought about the historical Bridget. And that was one of the things that actually started to annoy me. I was like, wait now, I was sold a pup and everyone was slightly sold a pup in that Bridget was very much so real. And we really need to, you know, get rid of that notion that she wasn't. And we can actually, some of us will be kind of looking into that in the conference. Actually, we have this amazing public lecture on the Friday evening at 8 p.m. in Maynooth University. So everybody, please come in. It's free. There's some drinks and nibbles beforehand. And there's a lecture by Harvard professor Catherine McKenna. And what she's going to really be looking at in that lecture is, what do we know about Bridget? You know, so the knowns and the unknowns, and where a lot of the stories we have about her, where did they actually come from? And it's brilliant. You know, she traces some very specific stories and says, actually, we can see that this was a story that was really only generated in the 1800s, or this was a story that was generated in the 1600s. This was a story that was generated in the 1200s or the 1100s. And she goes back through them, and it's brilliant. And the main thing is that so many of those stories actually don't go back to the time that Bridget lived, or the time when she really started, when we get a lot of texts written about her in the 7th century, so in the 600s. So they're kind of their later stories about Bridget, and they muddy the water a little bit. Mm. So they're brilliant and they're amazing traditions. But what we want to try and get back to here is, okay, let's, you know, peel back the layers and let's figure out actually that earliest history of Bridget.
Okay, well, we'll talk about the evidence such as it is in a moment. But talk to me first of all about Bridget, the Celtic goddess.
It's hard to talk about that because we just don't really have a lot of evidence for it in medieval Ireland. We just don't. So it's really tricky for me to say anything about it. That doesn't mean that there wasn't a pre-Christian. I mean, you say Celtic, it's hard to use that term. It's a very difficult term. It's only really suitable when you're talking about languages, you know, like Celtic speaking peoples. We don't know anything of like a religion or, you know, different kind of social practices, and, you know, we're limited. So Celtic is tricky. I think we should use terms like Irish, you know, or Welsh, or even, you know, things like in the area around 7th century Kildare, for example, you know, a term like Celtic, it's a big term that kind of, it rubs away all the complexity.
But she was venerated. There was somebody who was venerated in pre-Christian Ireland, wasn't there?
Have any evidence for it. All right. Doesn't mean there wasn't. We just don't have any evidence for it. And all the earliest references we have to kind of Bridget are references to a saint, Bridget. Now, listen, we do have, like my professor, David Stifter, the head of my school in Maynooth University, he's going to be getting into that a little bit in the conference, and that name, where that name Brigh and Brigid and Bridget, where that comes from. But we're limited. Kind of our first really clear written testimony to any kind of pre-Christian goddess with the name Bridget is in the early 9th century. And in that text, and it's an amazing text, Cormac's Glossary, he, in another section, talks about the Saint Bridget as well. So he doesn't conflate the two. They're two very different things. Mm. It's just hard. We just don't have any evidence for it, so it's difficult to talk about it.
Okay, what do we know about her family background, her kin group, the kin group called the Fothearts, if I'm pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, exactly. The Fothearts, you know, they, in all the earliest texts and the traditions associated with Bridget, the Bridget I know, you know, the Bridget who founded the Church of Kildare, they all say that she's part of that wider kind of dynastic group. They were based kind of like, kind of almost from maybe what's modern day Offaly, further east. It encompassed the area around what today is Kildare. They were a part of kind of an aristocratic group, but they weren't really like the big deal, like the big political power players at the time. So it is quite interesting that all the sources are very consistent in associating them with her.
You'd assume she would have to have come from a family of some substance in order to become an abbess, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, so...
Or would you?
Yeah, well, no... I think you had different roots, in fairness. I think people had different roots to kind of, if we want to talk about like ecclesiastical power. A lot of the abbesses and the abbots and the bishops and everything that we have in the Irish Church, they were well connected. They were perhaps related in some shape or form to, you know, the aristocracy, to the ruling, to the kings and queens. In terms of so the abbesses of Kildare, the women who followed Bridget in Kildare, a lot of them are very well connected and aristocratic. Bridget herself, the earliest texts say that she was the daughter. They're very consistent in that she's the daughter of a nobleman. Now, whether she herself would have had a title as grand as abbess, you know, it's difficult to know. What we do know is that she supposedly died around the year 524. We know by the early 600s that the abbess of Kildare was a big deal.
Mm. And the fact that she actually becomes an abbess, she is a woman in a particular society, a society governed by the Breton laws. What was the status of a woman in that society? One gets a sense that women had some status, at least in pre-Christian Irish society and immediately post-Christian Irish society.
Yeah, so again... What I'm learning, the more and more I study Bridget, why she is like the best topic in so many ways, is that there's so much complexity there as the position of women in the church and the women in Irish society. Unfortunately, women, to some extent, women's history has been kind of ignored by scholars, and we really need to correct that. So I might have a different answer to that question for you in a few years' time.
Well, we'll come back then.
There's lots of exciting research going on, but what the law texts tell us, so you refer to it as the Breton law, we kind of know it as early Irish law because it was the only law system there. The term Breton really, it marks out Irish law in the later period against English common law, you know. But in early Ireland, in the society that Bridget would have been living in and her subsequent abbesses, women had really limited legal status. They were very much tied in with their male kin. Their worth, their legal worth, you know, was judged as half that as of their closest male relative. So you have to understand then, this was a highly stratified society as well as a patriarchal one. So the mother of a king or the wife of a king, the daughter of a king, actually has a really high status in society because she's half the worth of her closest male relative. Whereas a male slave has no influence and he's just a piece of property. So it's not just gender that's going on. You know, there's status and understanding the laws has to be taken into consideration. But it's really impressive when we read of all of the women, and there are many in fairness that haven't been adequately studied, any woman that comes through those medieval sources in Ireland, they were really important, influential women who were getting a lot done. And what is fairly consistent is that the abbesses of Kildare, that they potentially were the highest status woman, the most influential woman in Ireland at any given time. And that's really impressive given how limited their legal status and their capacity and even things like they're considered biased witnesses in the law and in the courts, you know, and that women weren't generally given the ability to, you know, buy and sell land and inherit land that they could then pass on to their own children. So it's a very patriarchal and hierarchical society.
Now, evidence, sources, hard to come by, obviously, for this period. You're talking about something 1,500 years ago. One of the sources that is quoted, and I know you're particularly interested in and keen on, is The Life of Bridget by a man called Cogitosus. Can we trust The Life of Bridget by Cogitosus, given that it was written in the 7th century, like 150 years after her supposed death?
So again, there's a lot to that question. We can't, if we want to use a word like trust, there's two things to it. First of all, we have to understand what kind of text it is, what it's aiming to do. So these kind of lives of saints, the genre is called hagiography, which means holy writing. It's kind of like holy biographies. They're a very distinct form of literature. They're the most popular literature in the Middle Ages. And they're stories. Right? They're stories. They're not historical documents. They're not purporting to relate historical facts. Now, they do often, incidentally, but that's not their main aim. Their main aim is to be like a highly sophisticated, well-crafted story with a really beautiful beginning, middle and end, a structure that fits into, you know, the wider genre. But when you're talking about the time discrepancy, you know, that it's written so long after Bridget lived, as all of these texts are, actually, in fairness, when it comes to these texts in general, Cogitosus is potentially one of the closest, actually, that was written in terms of from the saint. So the lives that we have of Patrick are even at a further remove from Patrick. But yes, he's not going to tell us a whole lot about Bridget, what she was like, her personality, how she actually lived. But I do think Cogitosus tells us a good bit about how women in his time were living and how women in the Church of Kildare were living. And
which wouldn't have been radically different from a century and a half before.
Yeah, perhaps not. Exactly. One of the things we do probably have the same legal system in place. We can see from the archaeology what matches up and what doesn't. And that's what's really important here, is that medieval historians, you know, you're kind of like detectives, you know, you're matching together, you're gathering together so much evidence and you're seeing what corroborates, what contradicts. You can't just look at one type of evidence. You have to look at the archaeology, the material evidence, the linguistic evidence is really important, and all of the available written sources you have in Latin and in Old Irish. So it's really exciting, but you have to do a lot to bring all of those sources together to give you then, build up this picture of what was actually happening.
Now, there's also an interesting context to this, a kind of a super context, if you like, and that is the animosity, the dispute, the struggle for dominance between Kildare and Armagh. Just talk to me about that a little.
Yeah, so that is one thing that scholars who've studied Bridget or Patrick, indeed Patrick, the battle between, and I'm using the word battle, but the battle between Kildare and Armagh and perhaps also Iona for kind of primacy, for rulership, headship of the Irish Church in the 7th century has taken up a lot of our attention as scholars. And that was necessary. You know, it was a really big thing that went on in the 7th century, which is why now I think it's a good time to, OK, let's we've established what was going on with this battle for the head of the church and let's look at some other areas. But essentially, in the, let's say, perhaps around the year 600, it wasn't clear maybe which church was actually the head of all. So ultimately, what church became like, you know, the the archbishopric, let's say, in Ireland, or the main church that communicated with Rome. And we have correspondence between the Irish church and Rome. And you have letters that represent all of the Irish church, and they're signed by all the different, or they reference all the different leaders of the different churches in Ireland. And there needs to be one main church that it's coming from. And ultimately, Armagh is who wins out. But it was touch and go there for a while. And Kildare really gave Armagh a run for their money. And one of the things that they used to great effect was devotion to Bridget, and was that people were coming from far and wide to come into Kildare to venerate the tombs of Bridget and her her Bishop Conlade. And that is kind of, you know, to bring back to the conference a little bit.
The bodies are actually in the church.
But yeah, aren't they? The bodies were in the church at that time. We see that those relics of the veneration of relics, saints' relics, it was a massive part of the medieval church. It still is in many respects today. You know, you're able to feel that connection. Like, there's Bridget. She's not just a remote individual. She's someone who's close to me. I can go, I can visit her. You know, she's very much real and alive and part of the community. And we see that then relatively quickly we have references to the devotion to Bridget of Kildare's relics on the continent, you know, as early perhaps as 700 AD. So this veneration to this Bridget of Kildare, it spread quite quickly around Europe at the time.
So, I mean, Kildare was a kind of a happening spot, therefore, in the 6th, 7th century.
That's what I say, it was a hot spot. It was a hot spot of 7th century Ireland. It really was. It was, you know, come to Kildare. Cogitosis in particular is really promoting that side of things. He says, we have feasting, lots of crack to be had. You can, you know, you can catch up with people that you haven't seen in a while. You can have a good time, but you can also pray in the church and you can venerate at the tomb of Bridget. And that's why we're kind of, I'm personally anyway, kind of using this conference that's coming up to continue that tradition, you know, that kind of like maybe 1400 year tradition of, you know, come in, you know, we want to show you some hospitality. We want to show off our research a little bit and talk to you and engage with the public and give you a drink and, you know, a bit of something to eat and let's have the chats. And
I mean, you're a big advocate of bringing medieval history to a broader audience. You do a podcast, the Medieval Irish History Podcast. Are there challenges in communicating this era of history to an audience?
There are, but actually in some respects, it's easier, I find, I think, than my historian colleagues who study other periods of history. Because the second I start saying, when someone asks me what I do, everybody instantly reacts to, oh, yeah, cool. I went to Glendalough last weekend for a hike, or I went on the Viking Splash Tour, or, you know, something to do with the Vikings, or something through I visited Clonmite Noise, or actually there's a holy well by my house. Or, you know, in a lot of ways, people in Ireland, and even tourists visiting Ireland, this is the period of history that we're synonymous with.
We're not that far removed from it.
No, but, you know, like, it's our so-called golden age, and it's, you know, it's the Island of Saints and Scholars, but we all have some connection with it. We can see the Roth on the hill, and we can, you know, see, we can connect with so many. It's really part of our landscape. It's part of our history, whether you roll your eyes or not, perhaps it's something, you know, everybody enjoys, like St. Patrick's Day. Everybody's going to, I think Bridget's Day is going to be, that's feast day, that's going to be the big one, because we're all dying for a long weekend after the winter. It's going to be really interesting to see how people celebrate that. So we love going back to this period of our history constantly. So in a way, it's an easy sell for me. You know, I haven't ever had many difficulties, to be honest, in a lot of ways, you know, getting funding or kind of promoting my research or, you know, talking to communities and giving kind of public talks, because people are into it. The challenges are communicating that this, as I said, it's a science. We have to use the sources in the way in which they were written. You know, you do get people kind of co-opting this period of history, not just in Ireland, but in elsewhere, to kind of push maybe, you know, kind of extreme agendas, you know, kind of far right and kind of different things. And it is quite concerning.
White slavery.
There's so much going on. And I feel, and as well with our relationship now, currently with our neighbours in Britain and in the EU and America, kind of understanding our own colonial past and understanding what Irish society was actually like before the English came in, understanding that we had kings and queens and lords and ladies and a very complex society. It wasn't this beautiful
Alice Stopford Green environment.
Right, yeah, exactly. You know, and what Alice Stopford Green and others, what they were doing, you know, in the Gaelic Revival and at the end of the 1800s and the early 1900s, it was very specific to a particular, you know, political and cultural time. And it's amazing everything that they achieved. But we don't need to, you know, repeat stuff from the late 1800s and early 1900s now. We've so many scientific developments and technological developments, you know, in our own work. I'm able to just now, the digitization of manuscripts, you know, I don't have to go and necessarily travel to Oxford or to France or anything to go and see manuscripts. I can view them online. I can zoom in. We've so many advancements now, so many advancements in archaeology. We're making new discoveries the whole time. So, you know, we don't have to repeat the same things. And in fairness, we're not in our own field. But I do feel like we need to communicate those advancements maybe a little bit clearer to the wider public.
Well, you have certainly communicated your enthusiasm. The conference is called Bridget's Worlds. It's taking place this Friday and Saturday, 13th and 14th of September at Maynooth University. Find out more at bridget1500.ie/events. And we'll also put a link to the booking page on our own website. My guest is the organiser, Dr. Niamh Witcherly. Niamh, many thanks indeed for joining us this evening.
Thanks a million.
And after the break, we'll be hearing about what happened when Laurel and Hardy arrived in Cove back in 1953. Stay with us. Welcome back. In 1953, Laurel and Hardy were in the twilight of their long, illustrious careers. That year, while travelling on an ocean liner en route to Britain, they stopped over in Ireland, where they quickly learned just how much their comedy meant to the people here. Colin Flynn has the story.
On the 9th of September 1953, thousands of people lined the harbour in Cove, County Cork, to welcome two of America's biggest stars.
As they were coming across on the tender, they were aware that the quayside in Cove was just jam-packed full of people. They could hear screaming and shouting. There's a great photograph of them right on the edge of the boats. And the famous quote we know is, Stan turned Ollie and said, is the Pope on the boat?
Laurel and Hardy stood on the edge of their boat looking at Cove Harbour in amazement. And then what they heard next brought them to tears.
Because as they neared the quayside, the church bells of St. Colman's Cathedral started to ring out their theme song, which was the cuckoo song. You know, did-it, 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 did-it. And all of a sudden they knew it was for them.
Laurel and Hardy had become the most famous comedy duo in America, starring in silent films back in the 20s and 30s, and then moving into talkie films around the 40s, by which time their act had become iconic.
We've come to sweep this chimney.
Laurel portraying this clumsy, childlike character, with Hardy the pompous, frustrated one.
Here's another nice mess you've gotten me into.
But by the time the 50s had come around, in the US, their starlight was dimming, and they were, in a way, seen as Hollywood's yesterday's men. older, old-fashioned, the comedy simple and childlike.
I'm beginning to think that you're right.
You bet your life I'm right. You know, I'm not as dumb as you look.
But they still needed to make money, and that's what brought them to this side of the Atlantic in the early 50s, for a British comedy tour which also included Ireland, and they first came in 1952. To find out more about the story, what better person to ask than the Grand Sheik of the Laurel and Hardy Irish Society?
I am Liam Muldowney. I live in Dublin. I am the Grand Sheik of the Irish Laurel and Hardy Society, which is part of the worldwide association called the Sons of the Desert.
And Liam, great title, by the way. Before we talk about their incredible visit to Cove in County Cork in 1953, they'd been here before. Why was that?
Basically, their Hollywood careers, their movie careers, were over by the 50s. So as they didn't earn any residuals from their earlier movies like Chaplin did and Harold Lloyd did, they needed to make a few shillings. So they were approached by Bernard Delfont, who was a theatre guy in the UK, and said, look, let's put on a tour and let's try and make a few pounds for you. So they jumped at the chance to make some money and came over, and Ireland was on their agenda. So they had 2 weeks here in Dublin and 2 weeks up in Belfast afterwards. They stayed at the Gresham Hotel and performed twice nightly and matinees on the Saturday at the Olympia Theatre in Dublin.
Because of the success of these shows, the British tour manager invited the boys back the following year, but there was a mix-up with their visas.
Stan Laurel was born in the north of England, so he was obviously an Englishman. Oliver Hardy was born in Georgia in the States, so he was an American. His working visa had to be a year when he left the UK previously to when he could obviously go back again to work. And it wasn't a year when they were planning to do all this.
So in order to get around this, a last-minute decision was made to stop off in the Republic of Ireland before going on to the UK, where they planned to quietly write more material and work on their upcoming stage shows. So Liam, on September the 9th, 1953, the liner they were on, the SS America, pulled into Cove Harbour. I know that they were expecting to slip into Ireland quietly because their heyday was over.
Yeah.
But what happened? What was the welcome like?
I'd managed to interview lots of people who were there. We've spoken to many, many people who were the children at the time. The word got out, first of all, it was in the newspapers about 5 days beforehand that they were on the boat. And on the morning of that the boat arrived, the children went up to their headmaster in the boys' school and they said, can we go down to the quayside? Laurel and Hardy arrived. And this is about 11 a.m. in the morning. The story was they pushed the poor brother so far back into the wall because they all surrounded him that he eventually said, go, just go. And so they all ran, if you know where the school is in Cove, the boys' school, they all ran down the hill towards the dock. The girls found out about this and obviously did the same thing with the nuns. And next thing, the girls all came running down. And the sight that they've told me, that just all these children running down the hillside in Cove. The bank manager and his staff ran out of the bank, left the door open. I found a great letter from Stan Laurel who said we were in Cove Bank. Can you believe the bank manager and all his staff were there to greet us with the thousands on the quayside? And then he realised they'd all run out of the bank and left the door open. Can you imagine? Oh, it's a fabulous letter.
And Liam, when did they realise that this welcome was actually for them? And do we know how they reacted?
Well, they were expecting to just arrive, get a taxi to the train and get the train up to Dublin. And they were staying in Dunleary in the Royal Marine Hotel. Their SS America was the liner that brought them over, as you say. It had to dock out of Cove Harbour. Cove Harbour wasn't the harbour it is now. And a tender brought the passengers across. As they were coming across on the tender, they were aware that the quayside in Cove was just jam-packed full of people. Stan looked at Ollie and they were on there's a great photograph of them right on the edge of the boat. Stan looked at Ollie and was, oh, what's going on here? Next thing they could hear screaming and shouting and they're going, this is crazy. There must be someone on the boat really famous. Because as they neared the quayside, they could hear the children and the adults shouting Laurel and Hardy.
It was reported that when they left New York, they were barely recognized, and they feared that in Europe people might have forgotten them as well. But it was as they came closer to Cove, they heard a sound coming from the top of the magnificent St. Colman's Cathedral overlooking the harbor.
The church bells of St. Colman's Cathedral started to ring out their theme song, which was the Cuckoo Song. Stan looked at Ollie, Ollie looked at Stan. They burst into tears, overcome with emotion. It suddenly dawned on them that this welcome was for them.
Gardaí held back the crowds when they walked onto the shore, and overcome with emotion, they asked to see the people who rang the bells in their honour.
Stan and Ollie thought they were going to meet five or six or seven people who were pulling ropes to play these bells. But the bells of St. Colman's are, it's a carolling system. So there's only one man responsible, and he was a gentleman called Staff Gebroers.
Staff Gebroers was a Belgian man who was living in Cove, and he played the carolling at the top of St. Colman's. He met Laurel and Hardy outside the cathedral with his 10-year-old son Adrian by his side, who today is 80 years old and is still playing the carolling just like his father did.
I took over from my father in 1970. He started in 1924. He came here from Belgium.
And I met Adrian at the top of the steeple to hear his memories of that day.
How high are we now above the ground, Adrian?
At this stage, we're about 250 feet above sea level.
It's a spectacular view of Cove and Spike Island and all the surroundings.
Yeah, and remember, the main door of the cathedral is already at quite a height above sea level. I mean, the location of this building is absolutely spectacular. In those days, the liners didn't tie up with the quays. They anchored out in the harbour, and a tender brought the passengers in. So as the tender passed the cathedral, he played what was their signature tune. I think it was called the Cuckoo Waltz.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, carolings can have an amazing impact on people. They'd never heard bells like this before.
That must have been incredible for them.
Yeah, yeah. And when they came ashore, they said they wanted to see the people who rang the bells. They had visions of people pulling ropes, but that's not how it happens, of course. So they were brought up to meet my father. And I was with them then. And, you know, I had been looking at their films, but this completely put me off because they were older and they were dressed in ordinary lounge suits, not in the way they appeared.
They weren't goofing around.
No, precisely. And Ollie, the bigger of the two, he went to thank my father, and he was so overcome with the emotion he couldn't say anything. And he just embraced him. And I was completely confused then because my father was not a very big person. So will he ever come out of this embrace? Whereas Stan was saying polite words, saying how much they appreciated this and they never expected it and so on. So it was a great occasion for them.
Isn't that a wonderful memory?
Yeah.
After a few hours in Cove, they made their way to Blarney, where Stan Laurel kissed the Blarney Stone. But 25 stone Oliver Hardy said that nobody would be strong enough to hold him, as you have to lean over the edge to kiss the stone. So he opted out. And then the comedy duo made their way to Dublin.
Again, Stan was great for writing letters, and we still have a lot of those letters today. There's a great website, lettersfromstan.com. And we can go through the years and the times when they were here in Ireland and afterwards. And he wrote back to friends of his in the States. And the quote he said, going from Cork to Dunleary, was, "We autographed our way to Dublin."
This is Your Life, America's most talked about program. Now, here he is.
In 1954, Laurel and Hardy were honored on the This Is Your Life TV show in the United States. Over 30 minutes, various stars paid tribute to them and talked about the highlights of their careers.
Mr. Stan Laurel, Mr. Oliver Hardy.
But amazingly, at the very end of the show, the actress Vivian Blaine, who had starred with them in a movie called Jitterbug, mentioned that one of the highlights of their careers was not only the welcome they received in Cove, but the sound the cathedral bells made for them.
The great carolling bells of the Cove Cathedral began ringing. And this time it had nothing to do with a hymn or an anthem. This time, those wonderful old bells were ringing the cuckoo song.
How about that? Thank you, Vivian Blaine. Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy. Laurel and Hardy!
When they heard the bells and got that welcome and they cried, I think then they finally realized how loved they were.
Colin Flynn was reporting there. He was talking to Liam Muldowney and Adrian Gebrewers about Laurel and Hardy's visit to Ireland back in 1953. After the break, I'll be joined by Liam O'Callaghan, author of Blood and Thunder, a history of rugby and Irish life. Stay with us. Welcome back. How has Ireland, a tiny country where rugby is a minority sport, become one of the top rugby nations in the world? How has an all-Ireland rugby team been maintained despite political partition? These and many more complex questions are explored in a new publication which tells the story of this sport's long history here and its relationship with Irish society. The book is called Blood and Thunder, Rugby and Irish Life, A History. The author is my guest, Liam O'Callaghan, Associate Professor at Liverpool Hope University. Liam, many thanks indeed for joining us.
Hi, Miles. Thanks for having me on.
Now, just let's go back. I want to talk about the anthem issue, which is one of the things you raise very, very early on in the book. But how far back can we actually trace organised rugby in Ireland?
Back to the 1860s, basically, I would say. So Trinity College Dublin, the rugby club there, claimed to be the oldest existing club in the world, and they claim 1854 as their foundation date. Now, there was probably a club there at that stage, very likely, and they probably played football, but can we meaningfully call what they played rugby? I wouldn't be so sure about that. The idea that you'd separate football clubs that were very strictly denominated as soccer or rugby was a development for the future. And it was only really in the late 1860s that efforts to have one unified code of football were finally abandoned. So I would say in the 1860s, the club at Trinity became more organised. They were definitely the pioneers, and they developed their own rule book at that time as well. So I would date it to that time, and I would say their claims of 1854 are slightly anachronistic, to be honest.
And then how soon after that does international rugby get up and running, and are Ireland playing matches against, I think, first of all, England and Scotland?
So the first match against England was in 1875, and the second one was against them as well. And from then on, the international series of fixtures that we're now familiar with gradually took shape. Wales were added a little bit later, and France a little bit later than that. And France were periodically kicked out of the competition because they weren't all that faithful to the doctrine of amateurism at times. So from 1875, really. But it wasn't really all that brilliantly organised to begin with. The picking of the team was a slightly chaotic process, and scores of players only got one or two caps. So it was the kind of settled pattern we see these days of players getting many caps and having long careers was a development for the future.
And at that point, was it very much a Protestant sport? Was it very much a unionist sport?
Overwhelmingly so. So my research, I looked at the demographic backgrounds of every player that played for Ireland between 1875 and 1914. And what my research revealed was that of the first 100 men to play rugby for Ireland, covering a period of 8 years, and so up to around 1883, only two of those were Catholic. So the remaining 98 were Protestant. So it was very much a game of the Anglo-Irish elite in Dublin and in Belfast, which was kind of the second base of operations for Irish rugby. It was a game largely confined to Dublin and Belfast in its early years.
Now, so rugby essentially starts before the formation of the Gaelic Athletic Association. Obviously, Gaelic games were going on, or a variety of Gaelic games were going on. What were relationships like in the late 19th century between the two sports?
It depends on what way you approach the question, because a lot of sports people didn't really take much notice of the ideological connotations of sports. And what I mean by that is, obviously, the GEA were very quick to claim the nationalist high ground for themselves and to label practically every other sport as being foreign, in inverted commas. But that, as a set of ideas, took time to develop, and a lot of people were never really in support of that way of looking at things. But the sports were also quite separate, obviously, because it took time for rugby to broaden its appeal beyond the Anglo-Irish elite, as I said, and to attract Catholic players and supporters. And there was this sort of period in the 1890s when the GEA weren't really enforcing the ban, where you actually did have quite a bit of crossover between the two sports. I talk in the book about one particular rugby player called Tom Ahern. He was from West Cork. And Over the same weekend, he was selected to play rugby for Ireland against England and selected to play in an All-Ireland Gaelic football final for Cork. So you see kind of quirky little crossovers like that. But after 1901, when the GAA really begin to reassert this idea that sports like rugby are foreign and begin to implement the ban in a bit more of a severe way, you get quite a clear division at that point. In terms of relations between the two, the loudest people on both sides were the ones that most people heard. So you'd have GAA polemicists saying that rugby was foreign, but equally bigotry flowed both ways. So there was a degree to which the rugby establishment looked down through their noses at the GAA as well.
Now, when it came then to partition, when it came to the early 1920s, was there a period when it could have gone either way, when rugby could have split north and south? Was that a possibility?
I don't think so. You have to remember again that at the committee table level, let's say, until well into the 1930s, the IRFU was still a Protestant organisation, not in terms of the players on the pitch, but at the committee level, because all ex-presidents became members of the IRFU council and essentially had the whip hand over any decision that had to be made. So it was never likely to happen because the authorities north and south had built fraternal relations. They had similar backgrounds religiously and politically. As well as that, from the perspective of people in 1923, there was no guarantee that partition would last. And equally, the rugby authorities decided that they would just simply ignore the border. They pretended as if it didn't exist because they really wanted to maintain the unity of the game as far as was possible.
And at what point do the kind of Catholic schools, the Black Rocks of this world, which now dominate the kind of feeder system for rugby, at what point do they begin to assert themselves historically?
The 1880s. So BlackRock took up rugby around 1882. The Leinster Senior Schools Cup, which is the subject of much cultural and journalistic commentary, a level way out of proportion with its importance to the average person. The Leinster Schools Senior Cup was established in 1887, and BlackRock routinely won it from then. They dominated the competition right from the start. A very powerful idea soon took root in these schools, that the quality of the school or the prestige of the school somehow rested on the quality of the rugby team. So not long after BlackRock first entered the Senior Cup, you start to see other Catholic schools entering as well. So Belvedere, Castleknock and so on. And the prestige of the cup is there right from the beginning. There's a striking archival source at the BlackRock College Archives. It's a community journal that one of the priests kept throughout this period. And the volume of commentary in that little journal devoted to rugby just expands dramatically from the time the cup is inaugurated onwards. It's just a huge source of pride to the young men involved.
Now, rugby is seen as a middle-class sport, with the exception of Limerick. Is that an historical myth? Or
no.
There was, or there is, a working-class element in Limerick. Why? What happened?
Because they played it on Sundays. So just to expand on that a bit, it's a bit of a long story. But so from the very beginning, rugby in Limerick attracted Catholics and nationalists. And in the mid-1880s, a series of tournaments among little clubs that were formed in the laneways and terraces of the inner city, tournaments began to take place and they were staged on Sundays. And they were all managed by a club called Gary Owen, one of the famous rugby clubs of Limerick. And Gary Owen had at its committee table nationalist politicians, local notables. And rugby took on this kind of role as a beacon of civic pride in Limerick very early in its history. Now, the question you might ask is, why not the GAA? Well, the GAA at this time were in complete disarray in Limerick. Their county board split in 1887. And that kind of organisational chaos isn't really helpful when you're trying to attract people to the game. And by the time they recovered in the 1890s, rugby was too far ingrained in these communities and they simply wouldn't give it up. And they, as I said, they played it on Sundays. There was intense inter-parish rivalries. It was like Gaelic games under different rules. And of course, Sunday rugby wasn't to the liking of the IRFU. They looked down on it. They didn't approve of it at all. But because most of these clubs never affiliated to the IRFU, there wasn't really much they could do about it.
Now, you address the anthem question very early on in the book, and it's obviously a good metaphor for the challenges the IRFU, this cross-border organisation, faced. How does the anthem question pan out over the years?
Well, it was sort of this thing, Miles, that they tried to fudge for a long time. So the convention was, and trying to find written conventions in rugby is difficult. It's like the British Constitution. Everything is unwritten and done by precedent. The sort of convention that was in place after independence was that Auron Naveen would be played at Lansdowne Road as a gesture of respect for the host state. So that was the agreement that was made. It was in no way to be associated with the team. And that sort of arrangement held okay. What they did in Dublin was they wouldn't play the opposition's anthem, and that kind of underscored the idea that the only anthem being played was the one that was a gesture of respect to the state. But where matters came to a head was when the Rugby World Cup came around, and the usual pre-match conventions you associated with international sport, now it was felt needed to be applied to rugby. So Ireland, having not really given any thought to what anthem they would use in the 1987 World Cup, actually played the Rose of Tralee before their opening fixture against Wales, much to the embarrassment of the players. A kind of a saccharine love song like that, it really wouldn't be suitable for players about to play their first World Cup match. So a solution was needed, and that's how we ended up with Ireland's Call. Phil Coulter was commissioned to write something that was inoffensive, as rousing as it could be, and I think opinions are mixed as to how much he succeeded with that. I should also add that Ireland never had an anthem for away matches until Ireland's Call. So Auron Naveen was never played for Ireland's away matches. And of course, this was a compromise solution because rugby was a game that, since the early 20th century at least, a bit earlier, was a game shared by Northern Protestants and Southern Catholics. These people did not have a shared sense of Irishness, and that's why we all have all these compromises around anthems and flags and so on.
You write that during the height of the Troubles, certain players had to have security teams present.
That's right. So, for example, Jimmy McCoy, the prop from, well, he played for Bangor originally, but because there was an active threat to his life, he had to move to Dungannon. He was an RUC man there. John MacDonald, I think, was an RUC man as well. Brian McCall, these were all in the 1980s. He was a British Army officer stationed in Germany. So we know that simply by dint of their profession, these men were targets. So it took extraordinary bravery on their part to actually come down south for squad sessions and for matches. And they needed a really tight security detail. And it tells us something of their commitment to achieving their sporting ambitions that they actually persevered with that.
Now, you also go into the infamous years when the IRFU clashed with the anti-apartheid movement. I mean, Ireland had a very strong, very influential anti-apartheid movement. There was a great deal of pressure on the IRFU to boycott South Africa. Why did they for so long resolutely refuse to do so?
Because they had this very naive and foolhardy sense that sport, no matter what, could remain aloof from politics. That served them very well in managing North-South relations and the fallout from partition and the Troubles and so on. It served them very well there, but it was a disastrous decision when it came to apartheid, given the international consensus against it. And a colleague of mine has often likened international rugby apparatchiks as basically being the Freemasonry of sport. There are these strange ties of loyalty that cut across everything between these rugby officials of the various countries that play the game. And for some reason, the IRFU allowed that to supersede the express wishes of the government in Dublin. I mean, Charles Haughey, for example, called them in for a meeting in the midst of the hunger strikes in 1981 when he was facing into an election that he was in trouble in. And that gives you a sense of how much he wanted them to cancel their tour to South Africa in 1981. But they still persevered. They still went ahead with it. He told them this could be really costly in terms of our growing economic ties with Africa. Our sports teams could be banned from other competitions, but they just remained unmoved. It was international fraternity above the wishes of the government.
Well, the volume covers many, many more aspects of Irish rugby history than we've been able to touch on this evening. Once again, the book is called Blood and Thunder, Rugby and Irish Life, a History. It's published by Sandy Cove. The author is my guest, Liam O'Callaghan. Liam, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Miles.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher, Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer, Lorcan Clancy, goodbye, and thanks for listening.